Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this lovely Christmas Eve in 2006. Today I'm going to be joined on the phone for a program with the author of a brand new book about the history of labor radio broadcasting in the United States, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio. The author, Elizabeth Phones Wolf, will be on the phone line with us today. She'll be talking about the book, what happened in this rich history that's largely unknown to Americans, and what it means for us today. So join us today on Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The campaign to preserve network neutrality in Michigan has suffered a setback. The Michigan State Senate voted December 12th by a 2-1 margin to send a bill creating statewide video franchises to Governor Jennifer Granholm without any provisions to protect phone and cable customers from data discrimination. Although companies will receive statewide franchises under which to do business, they will come with no requirement that they provide statewide service. Because no federal statute exists to protect consumers' free choice of where they can travel online, grassroots net neutrality advocates in Michigan attempted to get language protecting open access to the internet attached to the franchising bill, but that effort failed. Governor Granholm calls the measure good for the state and thinks the issue of net neutrality should be handled separately by the legislature next year. She may have been influenced by last-minute phone and cable company promises to upgrade the state's telecommunications infrastructure, which may create some new jobs. In the state of New Jersey, which just enacted a statewide video franchising law in July, one major service provider may already be trying to flout the law. Verizon has filed a plan with the state's Board of Public Utilities for approval to wire the state for cable TV service. But the plan includes a provision that would allow Verizon to bypass communities it might consider, quote, impractical or unreasonably expensive, end quote, to build into. This language has raised concerns, especially for citizens in poverty-stricken communities in South Jersey, that Verizon may decide to ignore their access needs to television and broadband internet services. The Federal Communications Commission's also decided to weigh in on the issue of video franchising, promulgating an avenue for federal intervention into the franchise negotiation process. Under the plan, as outlined by FCC Chairman Kevin Martin, the FCC would impose a 90-day limit for phone and cable companies to come to an agreement with the communities they propose to serve. Meanwhile, the state of California has decided to hand over the long-term planning for its own telecom future to corporate stakeholders. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger recently appointed a task force comprised mostly of telecom executives to map out a plan to expand access to broadband in the state. One of its crucial tasks will be to develop policy on how to increase state authority over how public rights of way can be used to install new fiber optic data lines.
Recent exposés of television stations regularly passing off short-form infomercials as local news stories has taken a toll on the fake news business itself. MediaLink Worldwide, the largest purveyor of video news releases and yearly revenues of $30 million, noted in its most recent quarterly financial statement that income from fake news production and distribution dropped nearly 13% from previous year's sales figures. MediaLink attributes the slide to, quote, softness in the domestic marketplace, which can honestly be interpreted as an acknowledgement that TV stations may be finally realizing that they can't sell fake news as easily to viewers as they once did. We dodged several legislative bullets that would have given government expanded powers of surveillance on the internet when the 109th Congress adjourned. In addition to the defeat of a major attempt to reform federal laws to the advantage of phone and cable companies, bills that would have forced internet service providers to retain a host of data on their customers and would have provided companies with immunity from privacy-related lawsuits for assisting with government surveillance activities following 9/11, also died at the end of the session. Attempts to force broadcasters and webcasters to digitally encrypt all of their content were also defeated. But many of these issues may resurface when the 110th Congress convenes on January 4th.
One positive piece of legislation passed by Congress in 2006 was the Call Home Act. This law enables the federal government to seek ways in which it might be able to lower the rates for phone calls for soldiers deployed overseas. Not only does it direct the FCC to look into waiving certain fees charged on every call to exempt those in the military, it also directs the agency to investigate the costs of calls from places where troops are deployed. This is in partial response to allegations raised several months ago that certain phone companies may be gouging troops deployed in Iraq by assessing scandalous surcharges to their prepaid calling cards and even restricting the use of competitor services from bases and posts themselves. However, the bill does not give the FCC any hard deadline by which it must provide rate relief to the troops or report back to Congress with any of its findings. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois on this lovely December 24th. 2006. I'm coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today, our guest is Elizabeth Fones Wolff, the author of the brand new book, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio, published by University of Illinois Press just recently in 2006. Elizabeth Fones Wolff is a professor of history at West Virginia University and author of the earlier award-winning book, Selling Free Enterprise, The Business Assault on Labor and Liberalism, also published by University of Illinois Press. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the phone lines today, Professor Fones Wolff.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to be on the show.
You know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the air to discuss this book, in addition to it being a really outstanding book that I think people will be interested to read, even if they're not especially interested in history, but if they're interested in media, is that you really introduced the notion of labor, labor radio. And labor is so removed from media in the United States today, even compared to 30 or 40 years ago, this might seem like an entirely foreign concept to many of our listeners, especially listeners under the age of, say, 50 or 60. Before we talk about radio broadcasting, what has been the nature of the relationship between labor movement and media or press, traditionally or historically in the United States?
Well, traditionally, the press and the media, whether we're talking about radio, later television, and then certainly newspapers and magazines, has really been hostile to organized labor. And they either ignore unions, or in cases of union conflict, they are just—they tend to present the business side of the story, or business propaganda, or simply emphasize strikes and violence, and did very little with representing what were the goals of workers and what were the goals of organized labor. So it's really just a lot of discrimination against organized labor and the working class and the media.
Now, before the emergence of radio broadcasting, before television, we certainly had working people and we had the labor movement in the 19th and early 20th century. What was the relationship in this era between trade unions, the working class, labor, and the media, or the press, as it was often called?
Well, the press, again, in the 19th century, had the same kind of negative attitude towards organized labor. I think one difference is that in the late 19th century and into the early part of the 20th century is that the labor movement itself had a very vibrant and vigorous press, and so that workers had a chance to read, for instance, socialist newspapers like the Appeal to Reason, and so there was sort of more access for workers to alternative perspectives, and then labor press kind of, as we move into the 20th century, becomes much less vigorous and has a much smaller audience.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Appeal to Reason, which is the legendary pro-labor newspaper from the progressive era, published in Kansas, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Just before we go into radio, talk a little bit about that, because I don't think many of our listeners would understand just what a significant force this was in American society nearly 100 years ago.
Well, the Appeal to Reason had a huge audience. And then there were also lots of other socialist papers as well as labor papers in this period, and they really did provide the labor movement and also the left with a voice that has disappeared, and gave a lot of support to working people, to working people's causes.
Now, our guest today, Elizabeth Vones Wolfe, here on Media Matters, coming to you on WILL AM 580. We pre-recorded this show so I could selfishly take a day off on December 24th. So please don't try to call in. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show today, and have a happy holiday season. Elizabeth Vones Wolfe, author of the new book, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio. She's also a professor of history at West Virginia University. This is a brand new book just published by the University of Illinois Press. Labor radio begins really almost with the beginning of radio broadcasting in the 1920s. Isn't that right? I mean, labor got involved on the ground floor?
Yeah. Radio begins to spread in the early 1920s. Like, for instance, in 1922, about 2% of American households had radio, and then it spreads just about in the same way that the Internet and the web spreads in the 1990s, so that by 1930, almost half of Americans had access to radio. And then when you consider that group listening was common in the 1920s, that means that most Americans had access to radio. And there were a few people in the labor movement, really I would call them visionaries, who understood that radio was a way to bypass the mass media, you know, bypass the newspapers that were so hostile to labor, and to speak directly to the workers and to the public. So in 1926, the Chicago Federation of Labor establishes the first labor radio station, WCFL, goes on the air. And Nathan Gottfried has written a wonderful book about the history of WCFL and its struggles to gain a larger space on the spectrum and its struggles to survive. And it actually lasts for 50 years until the 1970s. And then we also have the establishment of a socialist radio station in 1927, the year after, called WEVD, after Eugene V. Debs in New York City. And this station doesn't have a direct connection to labor, although it gets contributions from the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and it provided access to labor in New York City. It gives a lot of time to the radio, to labor programs, and covers working class in New York City. So essentially, there's right in really with the beginnings of radio, we have two programs on the air that are quite, or two stations on the air that are quite influential.
Now, the labor movement in the 1930s had an explosion in impact in the United States, growth in membership. I think by any account, it was the most dynamic social movement of that era and into the 1940s, the era that really your book is about, that era going forward and into its decline. A lot of our listeners, especially the younger ones, again, might not be especially familiar with the main players of that era and their importance. Could you just identify or talk a little bit about the American Federation of Labor, what it was and is, and then the emergence of the CIO and what it was and is?
Well, the American Federation of Labor was founded in the late 1880s, and it brings together represented craft unions. And these are unions like the carpenters, the electrical workers, unions representing workers that had skills. And it has a fairly good number of unions, a good number of members, although in the 1920s, when the business community begins an open shop movement to attack labor, what we're going to see is that the numbers in the AFL begin to decline. In fact, it's very much like what's going on today. And the AFL tended to be quite conservative, mostly concerned with the interest of skilled workers who were primarily native-born, better paid, and had power because of their skills. And there was, in the early 20th century and up until the mid-1930s, there's large numbers of industrial workers who are in these emerging industries like the auto industry, electrical, and steel, who many of them are immigrants, many of them are women, and the AFL has virtually no interest in organizing these groups.
Now, Liz, if I get this right, Liz Vones Wolfe, we traditionally today associate organized labor with factory workers.
Right.
But prior to the 1930s, that would be inaccurate. I mean, the guts of the labor movement, at least the AFL, was in the building trades for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of them are in building trades, or if they're in the factories, they're only just the very skilled workers. So a
And the AFL, what was its attitude towards, and it was by far, it was the dominant federation of labor. Did almost all the major labor unions belong to it in the 1920s, going into the 1930s?
Yeah, most of them are in the AFL-CIO, which is, the AFL-CIO is essentially representing.
No, no, I mean back historically.
The AFL is the dominant labor organization of the period.
What was its attitude toward radio broadcasting when it came along in the 20s and 30s? How did the AFL as a national organization respond to this new technology, this new medium?
The AFL, although they were ultimately pleased that WCFL existed, because WCFL has a relationship with the AFL, they weren't particularly excited about taking advantage of radio, because most of the AFL members came in through the craft unions, came in not through major organizing drives, but simply because they served apprentices and became part of the union. And the AFL liked the idea, say, of getting free time on the radio, but they weren't particularly interested in using radio as an organizing tool. And they simply were not visionaries.
Did the what was in this period there? You know, WCFL, which started as the great labor radio station out of Chicago in the late 1920s, you know, I've read about it myself quite a bit, and they had a very antagonistic relationship with the dominant commercial networks, the NBC and CBS, especially NBC. They regarded them as the voice of business and as sort of illicitly getting domination over all the main channels in the country through their contacts with the government. What was the AFL's relationship with the big radio networks, NBC and CBS?
Well, they were really kind of compliant in the sense that they were happy to get any scraps of time that were available. The major radio networks would give labor time to do speeches on the air several times a year as part of their commitment to providing public service. And basically the AFL, William Green, who's head of the AFL, accepted the idea of a commercialized broadcasting system, and he was very happy to get whatever scraps of time were available. And so he's not particularly contentious, and he's very satisfied with the status quo.
Our guest, Elizabeth Vons-Wolf, author of the new book, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio, here in WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We pre-recorded this shortly before December 24th, so I could take a day off. So please sit back, relax. Don't try to phone in today. We're talking about labor radio in the 1930s and 40s and labor broadcasting in general and the effort of the labor movement in this country to use and interact with radio broadcasting in this crucial period in American history and in American media history. We've just been talking about the AFL. Now let's turn to the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. What was its birth? What was its relationship to the AFL? And then finally, Liz Vons-Wolf, what was its attitude towards radio broadcasting?
Well, the CIO represented workers in many of these new industries. Industries like the rubber industry, which is producing tires for the automobile industry, which is growing in the 1920s and 30s, for the electrical industry, which again is a new industry in the early 20th century, for the steel industry, for textiles. So these are all, in some cases, new industries with primarily semi-skilled and unskilled workers who had been overlooked by the craft unions. And some of these unions had representation in the CIO, when the AFL, and had been asking the AFL to put more effort into organizing these semi and unskilled workers. And in the mid-1930s, these unions, led by John L. Lewis, who comes out of the United Mine Workers, James Carey, who comes out of the Electrical Workers, broke off from the AFL and formed this new organization, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And again, within the title is this notion of the industrial union. And then beginning in 1935-36, they began massive organizing drives in industries like steel and rubber and auto and textiles throughout the nation. And there's really this massive upsurge of workers who go out on strike. They use new innovative methods of organizing workers, like in the auto industry, and actually not just auto, but throughout the nation, sit-downs, which enable them to put pressure on industry. And we see literally millions of workers surging into these new CIO unions.
Now, you talk about the Flint sit-down strike, or the sit-down strikes that had led to the automobile union being formed. How much impact did this have on American society? Was this something that was just happening in the sides, or was this something most Americans were familiar with? I mean, how prominent was the emergence of the CIO, of the UAW, the United Auto Workers, of the emergence of organized labor, a theme in American life between, say, 1935 or 6 and 1940?
It's really one of the dominant themes of American life. I'm literally on the front pages at all times. The union movement has a big influence on culture at the time. A lot of the New Deal arts agencies and social agencies will be working with organized labor. The movies of the period had positive depictions of workers. Because remember, this is a period of the Great Depression, and there's a lot of hostility towards business, a lot of hostility towards capitalism. So in a sense, labor can grab hold of this and really promote a sort of more, what some almost called a laboristic society.
Now, in your book, you talk in one of your chapters about the CIO and about its attitude towards radio and the relation of radio to the labor movement. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you found.
Well, the leaders within the CIO, a number of them, not all of them, but people like James Carey of Electrical Workers, John L. Lewis of the United Mine Workers, and then leaders within the auto workers, they all were extremely excited about using radio as both an organizing tool and as a way to build unions, to build union consciousness, and then also as a way to reach out to the American public. And, for instance, John L. Lewis would argue that through radio alone, he could help organize, for instance, the steel industry. And this was probably a bit of a sort of exaggeration. But they were extremely excited about it. They're very aggressive about going out and trying to get time on local radio shows. They launched some of their major organizing drives with a series of radio programs. They begin radio shows all over the country. So, for instance, in San Francisco, the Longshoremen begin a daily newscast that reaches over 300,000 listeners. The Steelworkers Organizing Committee has programs in Baltimore and in communities throughout Pennsylvania. They have a weekly program that reaches, again, out to workers. And I think that one of the things that's important to remember is that this is a period in the 1930s where the Wagner Act, which is the law that declared that workers had a right to organize, had just been passed, and it had not yet been defended in front of the Supreme Court. There's tremendous hostility towards the effort to organize workers, and workers knew that if they were seen talking to an organizer, that they could be fired. If unions tried to, in many communities like Jersey City or Aliquippa in Pennsylvania, if they wanted to try to come in and organize or they wanted to help workers organize, they had trouble renting halls. Or if they tried to hand out leaflets, in many cases they'd be beaten up by company thugs. So workers were frankly frightened, terrified of talking to organizers, showing any kind of sympathy to unions. And one of the things that the CIO realized is that radio was a way to reach these workers in the private sphere. It was a way to reach them in their homes, to talk about the importance of unions in bringing democracy to the workplace, the importance of unions in helping them raise their wages, to give them representation on the shop floor, so they could reach them in ways that was often difficult because workers were so fearful of the power of the company.
What was the relationship of the CIO and the CIO unions as they produced radio shows to go out over there? What was their relationship with the commercial broadcasters that had almost all the stations at this time, especially at that time, the two dominant national networks being NBC and CBS?
Well, that one of their problems was that they really had to struggle and scrap for airtime. The major networks, that is, there's actually also Mutual, but all the networks essentially refused to sell time to organized labor. What we see is that censorship, political censorship, was really part of radio from its very beginning. So, for instance, anything that broadcasters considered controversial, they refused to give airtime to. So labor, except in very constrained settings, was not allowed to buy time. Minority groups were excluded. Leftist groups tended to be excluded. Issues like birth control
were business
or atheism.
Groups excluded? I mean, if were business groups similarly precluded from using the airwaves by commercial broadcasters?
No. Broadcasters considered labor controversial, but not business. So, for instance, they would sell time to DuPont, which had a program called Cavalcade of America on the air, which would have sort of commercial segments in which they promoted DuPont, the company, and its ideology. The National Association of Manufacturers was able to buy time on local stations. Ford Motor Company in the 1930s had this program on called the Sunday Evening Hour, which was classical music, but in the halfway through, for about 10 minutes, the head of the personnel director of Ford Motor Company, William Cameron, would get on, and he would talk about the dangers of organized labor, the need to cut taxes. He attacked the New Deal. He attacked relief programs. So there's a lot of political stuff that's on the air from programs that are sponsored by business, and the networks like NBC and CBS were very happy to take them, but they refused to sell time to organized labor. Also, most of the large stations, the highest-powered stations, generally refused to sell time to organized labor. And so the programming that I was talking about in the 1930s is primarily on smaller stations that were willing to sell time. But even the smaller stations were often intimidated by local businesses, so they might agree to give time to, say, the rubber workers for a program that they're going to use to try to organize workers. And then they might go on the air for a couple weeks and then suddenly find that the station would say, no, we are going to cut, you know, you're too controversial.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Elizabeth Phones Wolfe, professor of history at West Virginia University and author of the brand new book, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio, just published by University of Illinois Press. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it shortly before Christmas Eve, so I could take a holiday today. So this is not a call-in day. Sit back, relax, enjoy the show, listen to this extraordinary history, largely unknown to Americans, and I think, as you'll see, perhaps of considerable importance to this country as we move forward into the coming generation. In your book, you talk a lot about something called the NAB Code,
mm-hmm.
The National Association of Broadcasters Code, or just the Code. What is this code? Where did it come from? How important was it in American society for what was available on radio, which, of course, at this time was the broadcast medium? We're talking about an era, the 1930s and 40s, prior to television. And how did labor respond to the code?
Well, the National Association of Broadcasters is a trade organization. It's still around today. And most of the largest radio stations belong to the NAB. And, of course, the networks were also affiliated with the National Association of Broadcasters. And the National Association of Broadcasters revised its code of ethics in 1939. And in revising the Code of Ethics, they were concerned because there had been a number of controversial things that had happened on radio recently. For instance, the War of the Worlds broadcast, which had frightened many Americans. There had also been some seemingly, for today, quite minor incidents, but at that time what seemed to be sexually suggestive incidents on radio. And so the NAB and many of the broadcasters were worried that there was going to be that the FCC was going to try to exert more control over the content of broadcasting. And I think that should probably sound familiar to what's happening today.
And we should just add for people perhaps not familiar with broadcasting, how it's regulated. Broadcasters then, as now, received licenses from the government to use scarce broadcast channels. They got monopoly licenses, and there were only a handful in every community. So this was not a free market industry, but it was an industry created by government monopoly licenses given to a scarce number of companies that were privileged to get them.
Yeah, and so the broadcasters were often worried that they might lose their licenses if they didn't stay in good stead with the Federal Communications Commission. And so in 1939, worried about the possibility of more regulation, the National Association of Broadcasters revised their code of ethics. And in revising it, the idea was that in the future, no stations and the networks would not sell time, that they wouldn't sell time for controversial issues. And so the idea was that some of the most controversial business shows would be knocked off the air, people like Fulton Lewis Jr., Upton Close, and these were business-sponsored news commentators who were kind of like the Rush Limbaughs of their period that went after the New Deal, that went after organized labor, called John L. Lewis all kinds of names, and in today's, if it was today, they would be calling Lewis a terrorist. In any case, the idea was that all of this was going to disappear from the air, and that in the future, in order to create an even playing field, the all stations and the network would provide free time for coverage of controversial issues. So the idea was that people who had money and power wouldn't be able to dominate the airwaves. Well, it didn't work out that way, because immediately the National Association of Broadcasters declared that organized labor was controversial, and that business-sponsored broadcasting, there was still no problem with that. So the upshot is that it simply meant that it becomes even harder for organized labor to get airtime, because some of the small stations that in the past had been willing to sell time to labor, they began to back away from organized labor. So, for instance, in Akron, a station that the rubber workers had a program, and this program had been very important in organizing the rubber industry, suddenly they found that they were off the air. And then in California, station KYA, on which the longshoremen had a terrific program, it was a daily news hour in which was all labor news, and it gave really the workers in San Francisco a voice. And this is a program that was heard for hundreds of miles, so it's on a very good station, KYA. Suddenly KYA, which had actually was owned by the Hearst Company, and the Hearst Company had been very concerned with this program and had fired the manager of the station for taking the program without clearing it with Hearst. So they'd been trying to find a way to get rid of this really influential program, labor program in San Francisco that went on the air in 1937 and is extremely popular. They got something like 1,000 letters a week from listeners, and it's heard all over the West Coast. They use the NAB's code as an excuse to get rid of the station, to get rid of the program. And I was able to find letters from the Hearst Company in the FCC papers at the National Archives. And this is their internal company correspondence where they say, let's use the code as an excuse to get rid of this troublesome radio program.
You said that these radio shows were extremely popular, many of them, which I think will be a surprise to some of our listeners who probably, when you think of labor media, I think, if there's any impression in people's minds, it would be of some sort of boring, droning talk of some labor bureaucrat mouthing out something that would be incomprehensible. You've listened to a lot of these shows, I know. What was a labor radio show like in the 1930s?
Well, a lot of them are really talk, because in the 30s, mostly they're going to get on and give speeches, so local organizers are going to get on the radio and talk. But they did try to do more innovative things to get local workers on the radio. They would do little soap operas sometimes. I mean, part of it is that there wasn't a lot of money available to do any kind of really sophisticated programming. I think you really heard the genuine voice of the labor movement, the genuine voice of local unionists on the radio in this period.
Well, the NAB code goes into effect at the height of the labor movement's really success and power in late 1930s, early 1940s, and takes all these really important shows for CIO and for the labor movement off the air. So this produces, it seems like, somewhat of a crisis for the labor movement and for progressive politics in this country with regard to broadcasting, as we're just on the eve of World War II, the U.S. entry into it. How does the labor movement respond?
Well, initially, the American Federation of Labor was rather complacent. they weren't particularly concerned. But as when we get into World War II, there's the organized labor joins in the war effort, but there's also a lot of conflict on the shop floor because there's a lot of push for production, and labor wanted to use the this as an effort to expand its influence. And there are, before the United States actually gets into the war, a lot of strikes as labor is trying to finish organizing, for instance, the Ford Motor Company, and labor is organizing on the new aircraft factories on the West Coast. And so some of these business commentators, like H.V. Kaltenborn, just go after the AFL, attack the CIO. And so finally, the AFL begins to realize that they need to begin to be mobilized. But it's really the CIO that begins a campaign for media equity. And they argue that labor had a right to the air, that they talked about the Radio Act of 1934, which said that broadcasters had to serve the public interest. And the CIO argued that radio should be neutral and should present both sides of issues, and that it should cover all important social issues, and this particularly included the rights of labor to the air. And so the CIO, and eventually with a little bit of help from the AFL, will begin to mobilize during the war and begin a major campaign to break the code and to get access to the air. And one of the things they do is that they essentially teach many of the locals how to protest to the FCC. One of the things that we need to remember at this time is that the FCC was really the last bastion of New Deal liberalism, in the sense that the head of the FCC, James Lawrence Fly, and some of the commissioners like Clifford Durr were very sympathetic to organized labor. These guys were real liberals who wanted to see that labor have a voice on the air. And they're very critical of the way, for instance, during the war, that business, how much influence business companies had over the news and over the media. And so they're willing to listen to these protests, although initially they say there's not a whole lot we can do. The labor movement also argued that a lot of these broadcasts, these news broadcasts, were unfair to labor, that they were biased. And generally, the broadcasters would say, well, that's not true, you know, that there's not a whole lot of bias in our broadcast, that we give both sides of strikes, that we're not particularly critical of labor. And so what the CIO did was that they began a program of monitoring news broadcasts, monitoring, for instance, the broadcast of Fulton Lewis Jr., H.V. Kaltenborn, and monitoring the content.
And what years are we talking about now, Liz?
This is in 1944.
Okay, during the war.
Yeah, during the war. And they then did a quantitative study and essentially came up with the proof that there was a tremendous amount of bias that was coming out of the networks and coming from these commentators, from the news programs, from all kinds of programming, bias against organized labor. And so they're going to use this as evidence, as a way to try to overturn the code. And what happens is that all during the war, labor's having trouble getting access, and even in some cases when they can find a station that will ignore the code, the stations were constantly censoring what went on the air. So in Columbus, Ohio, the Curtis Wright plant, the UAW, wanted a program, not so much to organize, because these workers were now organized, but as a way to communicate with the workers, because this is a huge plant. They're also interested in 1944. They're interested in having an influence on the election. They're interested in local politics, national politics. They wanted to support Roosevelt. They wanted to support the Democrats. And they also wanted to have a voice. And so this actually was a very innovative program. This is one which they kind of used, brought on music, but then also had kind of used drama, kind of soap opera, to gain the attention of the listeners. And the owners of the station, WHKC in Columbus, were upset because they decided that there was too much controversy on this program, and they began extensively censoring their scripts. And so the UAW then decided that they would challenge WHKC's license, and they went to the FCC and asked that WHKC's license be denied. And eventually they become involved in a hearing having to do with whether WHKC should be able to keep its license. And the FCC actually allowed the UAW to actively intervene, to be involved in the questioning of the station owner. And ultimately, the FCC will rule in the WHKC case that stations had to cover controversial issues, that they had to provide time for all points of view. And this really is going to open up the airwaves to organized labor, because essentially the FCC said that stations had to sell time to labor. And one of the significant things about this particular case is that it becomes really the groundwork for the Fairness Doctrine, which is implemented in 1949, and is really a critical doctrine in the sense of opening up the airwaves to a lot of different groups and guaranteeing that both sides should be represented, and also that all kinds of key social issues like civil rights as well as race, needed, that stations needed to provide time on the air for these groups and for these issues.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Professor Elizabeth Phones Wolf, professor of history at the West Virginia University and author of the brand new book, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio, just published this year by University of Illinois Press. Professor Phones Wolf is joining us on the phone, but we're taping this shortly before going on air on Christmas Eve so I can take a day off this week and enjoy time with my family. Professor Phones Wolf, in your book, towards the second half of the book, you really go into the coming out of the war into the late 1940s. And I think for a lot of Americans today, especially younger Americans, there's sort of a catchphrase history. Yes, you have the New Deal, the Depression, the labor movement in the 30s, then you have World War II. And then in 1945, everyone moves to the suburbs and goes shopping and we live happily ever after or something like that. Your book presents a very different picture of organized labor in the 1940s.
Yeah. When World War II ends, organized labor is in many ways at the height of its power. And they, at that point, envisioned organized labor and unions really becoming one of the major institutions in American society, that in factories across the country, that decisions would be made not just by management, but also be made by labor, and that we would really have a democracy in the workplace. And that also that labor would be represented in all the social institutions in society, and they envisioned that labor would be a powerful political force in society. So labor has true ambitions, and the business community was really worried at this period because labor really did seem to have a tremendous amount of power.
And how did this play out in the battle over broadcasting?
Well, when World War II ends, this is a moment when there seems to be a chance to bring real change in the American broadcasting system. There's a new spectrum available, and this is FM. FM had innovation of FM had gone back to 1930s, but it had really been put on hold during World War II. And so when World War II ends, is now the opportunity to begin licensing new FM stations. And the idea here was that the FM stations would break the monopoly of AM. Most AM stations were owned by businesses, by manufacturers, or by newspaper interests. And again, these are all groups that were tended to be anti-labor, tended to be quite conservative. And the idea was that FM, the opportunity of perhaps 500 new stations, that this would be an opportunity for new groups, for veterans, for labor, for citizens groups, for cooperative groups, to break into radio. And so the CIO will join with other progressive groups, like the National Citizens Political Action Committee, and an array of other progressive groups, calling for three-quarters of the new stations, these new FM stations, to go to local groups, and that there should be a limit on the number of stations that any particular entity can own, and that they envisioned the FM stations as tending to reduce commercialism, to emphasize public service, to create democracy in the media. Again, they're emphasizing diversity of ownership, and they're also concerned, like the FCC was in this period, with the idea of localism, that radio should represent local communities and that local communities should have a voice in what's available in their media, and it's a way for local stations to be really representing the community in ways that weren't happening at the period. And they enunciated a concept that they called listeners' rights. And this is the idea that listeners should have some influence over broadcasting. And what the CIO does in concert with these other groups is that they sought to actually intervene in the licensing decision-making. So the FCC, again at this point, Clifford Durr is on the one of the key commissioners, and he encourages the FCC to actually go into communities and hold hearings to let local people talk about what they envisioned that their local station could do. And so these are open hearings, and listeners have a right, these are local community groups, to talk about who they think should own the stations. And the hope was at this period that we'd see a real change in the nature of broadcasting, that FM would be able to challenge AM and be a different kind of spectrum.
And what happened?
Well, what happens is that business community mobilized.
No, just what years are we talking about?
This is 1947, 1948.
Okay.
So this is 1949. So there's hearings, hundreds of hearings all over the country. And the FCC, is in a frenzy of giving out licenses to companies, to individuals who are all applying because they all want to break into FM. FM's really on the ground floor. So there's an opportunity to get hold of stations. And so, and these reform groups, many on the left, see this as a chance to really have an influence on American broadcasting and to challenge AM for dominance. And what happens is that, remember, the other thing we need to remember is this is 1947, 1948, and we're at the beginnings of the Cold War. There's rising fear of communism in the United States, and it's an issue that business can grab hold of and use to delegitimize groups on the left, and that's exactly what happens.
Mm-hmm.
The National Association of Manufacturers, with the aid of the American Legion and with the aid of business groups and with AM broadcasters and the networks, red bait the reformers and charge that they're all communists, that the communists are trying to get hold of broadcasting in the country. Put a lot of pressure on the FCC to back away from giving, from licensing citizens groups. And labor has enough influence that they're going to end up with 12 licenses, but ultimately most of the FM licenses go to AM stations, which tended to simply replicate their AM broadcasting, which tended to be excessively commercial with little interest in public service. And they also go to newspapers. So FM, this hope that the public and that listeners would have some influence over broadcasting, it's there in this period like 1945 to 48, 49, and then it just, it's in their grasp and it disappears.
Elizabeth Vones-Wolfe, our guest today, professor of history at West Virginia University, author of Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Media, just published by University of Illinois Press. We've been talking about the book today on Media Matters. We've only got, 10 minutes or so left in the show. Again, this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a few days before going on air. So please sit back, relax. Don't call in today. Just take back. We'll be back with a live show. As usual, 1 week from today. You talked, Professor Vones-Wolfe, about red baiting as becoming a major issue that really undermined labor's ability to have success at getting changing the FM radio system as it came along in the late 40s. What about the Taft-Hartley Act, which is also in this period, which is another, like the Wagner Amendment or Wagner Act in 1935, a seminal date in labor history, is often talked about today. What was the Taft-Hartley Act, and what did that have to do with all of what we're talking about?
The Taft-Hartley Act made it more difficult to organize labor by saying that states could pass laws that meant that workers, even if the majority of workers had voted for the union, that all the workers didn't have to be part of this of the union of particular plan. It's a little bit complex, but the main issue was that it meant that it was going to be harder to organize. And so Taft-Hartley is being debated in 1946 and 1947, and the labor movement is appalled because they had felt that finally they had the federal government on their side, that the government was helping, not helping to promote labor, but that at least they had a level playing field. And so the AFL, and this is a case where it's really the AFL taking the lead, the American Federation of Labor mobilizes to try to stop the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act. And the AFL's effort, at least in terms of radio, is led by this guy named Morris Novick, who came out of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, had been program director for WEVD. This is the socialist station in New York City. Also program director of WNYC, which was a nonprofit station run by the city of New York. And he came up with this idea that that the AFL should buy airtime. And now, because of the WHKC ruling, they were able to buy airtime, that they should go to ABC and buy airtime and run a network campaign against the Taft-Hartley Act. And so for 6 weeks in the spring of 1947, the AFL is on the air. They had 2 to 3 times a week network programs. These are in prime time, a number of variety shows where they had not just music and comedy acts, but they also brought on civic and religious and industrial leaders who talked about why Taft-Hartley would potentially damage organized labor. And a lot of actors and entertainers that we're still familiar with, well, at least some of us are still familiar with, people like Gregory Peck, Jimmy Durante, Milton Berle, Benny Goodman, they're all performing on this show. They're all proudly talking about their membership in organized labor. And at the same time, these are programs that are on in the evening prime time. For 6 weeks, they ran a network soap opera. And again, soap operas were written by people like Arthur Miller and some of the best writers in the business. And they brought on a variety of well-known actors like Melvin Douglas, who acted in these soap operas. And the soap operas dealt with the sort of problems of workers and just suggested about how much harder it was going to be for these workers if organized labor has difficulty, you know, if it's difficult to organize their plants. Talked about the problems of low wages, the impact of increasing prices, and really you get a feel for working class life by listening to this working class soap opera that's on for 6 weeks in this period. Now, unfortunately, the campaign didn't work. But on the positive side, it really got the AFL thinking about the power of the media, the power of radio, because they did get a huge number of listeners. I had the opportunity to read some of the letters that were written by listeners who spoke about how the programming really touched them and how important it was to them. And so we're going to see the AFL begin to move towards the idea that they needed to have a national voice on radio.
And what did the AFL do then to build out this national voice in radio following 1947?
Well, in 1950, the AFL began sponsoring their own network news hour, well, not a news hour, about 15 minutes to a half an hour. First, they put on Frank Edwards, who essentially has a news broadcast from the labor perspective. And he's on the air over 176 stations, first on Mutual Network and then later on ABC. And then he's followed up by Edward P. Morgan. And Edwards and Morgan had a huge listenership. Literally 8 to 10 million Americans were listening to these programs. They were on every evening, sort of prime time. And one of the things to remember is that this is certainly the era of television, but there's many American households that didn't have television. Lots of people are still listening to the radio. And so they had an opportunity to listen to the news, given from a labor perspective, a news that was very much promoting liberalism, promoting public education, talking about the importance of how unions contribute to the community, criticizing the Republicans in many cases, emphasizing issues like increasing the minimum wage, increasing Social Security, pushing for health care for the elderly. Actually, ironically, when you read the scripts from this period...
And now we're talking the 50s?
And this is in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. This is in the 1950s. The issues are really much the same. They're debating Social Security, the viability of Social Security, and here's organized labor in the 1950s pushing for the expansion of Social Security, and Social Security will expand in the 1950s, although the National Association of Manufacturers and most businesses in the 1950s at that period, just like today, wanted to get rid of Social Security.
Our guest today, Elizabeth Phones Wolfe, author of the new book, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio. Liz, we only have got a couple minutes left. The book ends, of course, with really the decline and demise of labor, radio and television broadcasting. And with that, I think, is it a coincidence that we see the long path of the demise and unraveling of the labor movement? How closely related, I guess is another way to put it, is the success of labor as an institution in American society been connected to its ability to communicate effectively in broadcasting?
I think they're really closely tied, because I think until the 1960s, people heard the union leaders, people heard workers on the air. You know, I can remember, I grew up in the 1960s, and I knew who George Meany was. I knew what the AFL was, the AFL-CIO was. I knew about the kinds of contracts that steelworkers were getting, and was amazed that steelworkers actually would get sabbaticals. And here I was as a teenager. People heard labor on the air all the time. Unionist Walter Reuther had a standing invitation to appear on Crossfire. All of the Sunday afternoon shows and even the morning shows would invite labor leaders to participate. So in other words, the public heard organized labor. They were familiar with the leaders of organized labor. And so it meant that labor could help set the political agenda, that labor radio enabled workers to provide a real alternative to the corporate-dominant mainstream media. Americans were familiar with unions. Unions were seen as a legitimate institution. And when labor backs away from radio, and we're going to see this happening in the mid-1960s as labor becomes increasingly complacent. And so they stop. A lot of labor programs are canceled. They're off the air. And I think that, you know, it's certainly not the only reason for the decline of organized labor. We're going to see increased corporate hostility in the 1970s. We're going to see changes in labor laws that are going to make it harder to organize and keep shops organized. But I think you can see a link in the decline in union broadcasting with the decline in the numbers of workers who are organized, and also growing sort of public hostility towards organized labor.
On that note, Liz, unfortunately, I'm getting the signal that we're about the end of our time. I want to thank you, Elizabeth Phones Wolfe, author of Waves of Opposition, for joining me today on Media Matters. I'll be back 1 week from today.